am here with Lynn Povich, who is most recently the author of The Good Girls Revolt. Lynn, how are you doing?
I'm well, thank you.
So, let's get right down to it. When Oz Elliott, the Newsweek editor-in-chief, initially responded to the lawsuit that you filed with Newsweek, and this is sort of my question to get you to talk about that lawsuit, but let's go ahead and get the background first. He said in his statement that the reason that most of the researchers at Newsweek were women and virtually all the writers were men were, in his words, because of a news magazine tradition going back almost 50 years. Now, he said this despite what you describe later in the book as a waspy social conscience. So why was this tradition, which originated from Henry Luce and Brit Haddon, I mean, why was this tolerated for so long, especially when you had some women who had to settle for this second-tier treatment and often give the best years of their lives? Let's talk about the origins of this problem.
Well, yes. In fact, when Henry Luce created this system of all of the researchers being women and all of the writers and reporters being men, Oz, who worked at Time magazine at the time, said this was great for women because it got them out of the steno category and they could actually do editorial work. So at that point, which was in the in 29, it was considered more liberating than being a secretary. However, and Newsweek copied Time. However, by 1960, it was pretty clear that, you know, well-educated women coming out of the same schools as men, with perhaps no prior experience, as many men did not have, and some prior experience, as some men had, were hired into this entry-level category and couldn't be promoted out of it. And women who really wanted to be journalists that young and knew it, like Nora Ephron and
yes.
Jane Bryan Quinn and Ellen Goodman and Susan Brownmiller, they saw the lay of the land pretty quickly and they left.
Yes.
And the rest of us good girls, as I call us, were probably first happy to get a job, especially in a place that was so interesting about the news, working on sort of the matters that really were important, and having this sort of special pipeline to the truth. And as one of the writers said, you know, we were all blind in many ways. I mean, the women bought into it, the men certainly bought into it, until one day we didn't.
Yeah.
And I think the fact that the women's movement happened as many of us in the mid-60s were coming into the workforce helped us realize, certainly helped me realize. I was reporting and writing at the time. I was a junior writer, and I started covering the women's movement. And I suddenly realized this isn't just about those women. Hey, there's something wrong with this picture for us at Newsweek.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when a bunch of us started organizing.
Were there any other efforts in organization before yours that fizzled out that you were aware of when you were organizing with your fellow women reporters or women researchers at Newsweek, aspiring, of course, to be reporters? I mean, were you aware of any other cues or efforts to rebel against this? I mean, I'm really curious as to why such a, quote, tradition lasted for so long and why good old Oz, who actually upheld that for a while, eventually was forced to turn back. You know, what was the impulse to, number one, cause him to change? And number two, the other question is, you know, why weren't women revolting against this?
It's a good question. Well, first of all, during World War II, there were women writers,
yes,
as there were in many professions where women sort of took over men's jobs. But by the early 60s, they had all left. And there was one woman who managed to get out of research into writing in the early 60s and was promoted to being a correspondent in Paris. So she was already writing in Paris when we were back in New York, and therefore
this is at Newsweek.
At Newsweek, there were still no women writing.
It's interesting to set the woman to New York, just like Janet Flanner at the New Yorker.
Right, exactly.
Somehow women can understand Paris, right?
And she was a brilliant writer and reporter. She was fabulous. She just didn't happen to be there when most of us were hired. She had left to go to Paris. So we were presented with this situation of all of us being researchers and the guys being our bosses. It's interesting because even though the Civil Rights Act passed in 1964, when the person who actually first started our revolt, Judy Gingold, who was a Marshall scholar who came back from England and could not find a job,
yeah,
except as a fact checker at Newsweek, when she was talking to a lawyer who told her that our situation was illegal, she couldn't believe it. And she said, well, you know, I don't think the guys know it's illegal. I think we should just tell the guys.
Yeah.
And the lawyer said, call the Equal Employment Opportunities Commission, you'll find out. And so she called them. They said, yes, this is illegal. And she said, well, shouldn't we just tell the men? And the woman at the other end of the line said, are you crazy? People in power don't want to give up power. If you tell them, they will promote two women, co-opt your movement, and it will be finished. You have a clear-cut case, and you have to sue.
Yeah.
So my feeling is that they didn't know it was illegal or realized it was illegal because it had been accepted as a woman's job for so long. It had been a tradition.
Yeah.
And in terms of, and of course, it benefited men. And their circles were men. I mean, they hired guys right off the Harvard Crimson and the Yale Daily because that's where they were from.
Yeah.
And their circle, as we know, in corporate America still, if it's a boys' club at the top, your sources are guys.
Do you think these men were conscious of the fact that they were playing into this sexism or that this was sort of an automatic power structure that they fell into? I mean, you know, how difficult was it to... I mean, we were talking about Oz Elliott changing his mind. How difficult was it to get other men who were in positions of power to change their mind, even before you filed the lawsuit? Or was it fairly steep in the culture?
Well, I have to say that many of the men at Newsweek were supporters of ours.
Yeah.
Certainly the writers we worked with and who knew how smart and talented many of the women were, they supported us from the very beginning.
Yeah.
And Oz Elliott, as you said, got it right away. He told me that Monday he realized we were right. Now, this is a man who put Newsweek on the map because of his civil rights coverage.
Yes.
And they were very proud of their progressive views on civil rights and Black Americans.
A great irony.
Yes, and at the same time, hadn't realized that in front of their noses was this horrible injustice happening to the women who worked for them. Oz Elliott also has three daughters. And my pet theory is that men with daughters are far more open and respectful of what women can do.
Yeah.
But like all organizations, or many organizations, the actual discrimination came in sort of middle management. For us, it was the senior editors and the top couple of editors under Oz. That happens a lot in corporate America.
Yes.
And many of those guys were against affirmative action. Anna Quinlan has a wonderful quote she told me I always say I'm an affirmative action baby and I'm proud of it. I wouldn't have gotten where I was without it. And she feels the same way. And she says when people look at her strangely about that, she says, if you think affirmative action is promoting a second-rate talent just because they're female or Black, you're looking at one. And so I do think a lot of people were against affirmative action. They thought that this was not a good idea. And they also didn't look at women, frankly, as capable professionally, either because of their own backgrounds, because of power, whatever it was. But, I mean, I was told that promoting me was one of the worst decisions that the editor ever took at the time. We were told when we filed the suit, one of the top editors said, why don't we just fire them all? We don't need them. It's complicated. You know, it's a Rosa Parks, I call it our little Rosa Parks moment.
Yes.
Everybody went to the back of the bus until one day you didn't.
Yes.
And one day we didn't.
There's one fascinating article you bring up in the book, which I didn't even know about. It's this article in Harper's. It appears in 1964. It's by Otto Friedrich. He is mocking the fact checker's role at news magazines. Friedrich points to midnight hamburgers and tears in the ladies' room. And as you write, Faye Wiley writes this letter to the editor, and Friedrich responds, I am mortified at the accusation of ungallantry. So the thing I have to ask about this is, was Friedrich's article, is this the typical male attitude at the time towards researchers? Would you say that his critique was more predicated upon, say, upholding gender roles and power dynamics than, say, questioning a news magazine's organizational structure?
Or? Well, I think he meant, I mean, the article by Friedrich was questioning this whole structure,
yeah,
of being able to put in a space to be fact-checked later and allowing a writer to write an entire story without any facts.
Yes.
So he was critiquing the system. However, because only women were fact checkers. He described women in that piece very condescendingly.
Yes.
And in that case, Faye Willey, who was the head researcher in the Foreign Department at Newsweek and a PhD in American Studies or a Master's in American Studies, and who probably knew more about foreign affairs than many of the men she was fact-checking.
Overqualified.
Yes, took umbrage at this and wrote this letter back to him, not only saying that he was ungallant in his critique of the women, but that he also had four facts wrong in his own piece. So I think it was both. I think that many men, and maybe more at Time than Newsweek, I don't know, looked at these young sort of office maidens as their step maidens to just carry out what they were supposed to do.
Was the word maiden used in the office?
Not really. The Nation researchers were called dollies, but only in Nation. I think it started as a bad joke.
Yeah.
But they literally called them to their face dollies.
Yeah.
None of us had that.
So then if Friedrich was offering a legitimate critique of news magazines, why do you think that it came saddled with this sexist, sort of misogynistic viewpoint that women were having tears in the ladies' room and so forth? Was this just the way that any kind of occupation at that time that featured women prominently, was this just the way that any so-called op-ed person would think about women vocations at the time? Or?
Well, I don't know about in general. I think that because of the system, ultimately, the fact checker is responsible for why something is wrong,
yes.
Not the reporter who misreported it or the writer who either didn't check it or misspelled it or whatever. So that in itself is very curious. I mean, in newspapers, as you know, a reporter goes out, reports the story, comes back, writes the story, and is responsible for the accuracy of the story. So only in this weird segregated by gender system that Luz created does this arrive. In terms of how people looked at women in their offices at the time, you know, there were women reporting in many publications, newspapers around the country. At some point, they were segregated onto the women's pages. But, for example, Business Week magazine hired women writers right out of college and put them as writers, and they were very talented and worked next to the women. So I think corporate cultures depend, I always believe, on the top and who's at the top, and it sort of trickles down from there.
So before the Newsweek lawsuit, how many of other magazines were taking cues from Luz in terms of this segregation model?
Well, only Time and then Newsweek and then U.S. News did somewhat.
Reader's Digest, you mentioned as well, and they also did a very, they basically said, well, why are women complaining? We're treating them well. That
right.
was their aspect.
Reader's Digest, which had many women working from them in these categories, a lot of in fulfillment, which was the least fulfilling job at all. So they treated them badly. I mean, they didn't pay them well. And yet they gave them dinner to go home because they were concerned that they would be able to feed their family. So it was a very paternalistic culture towards women.
So the only way they could really fashion respect was on this sort of paternalistic model? Or were other magazines or newspapers of the time, was there anybody around that was respecting women before the Newsweek lawsuit?
You know, there probably were. As I said, Business Week had a good number of women writing for them. So women who also had been hired in the war who continued to work there. I don't know. I mean, since I only know the history of newspapers and sort of women's pages and how hard women fought to get off the women's pages, I assume that was fairly common with certain exceptions. Flora Lewis became, you know, a foreign correspondent for the New York Times. New York Times always had various stellar women in certain areas. But I don't know. I mean, you know, we were the first women in the media to sue.
Yeah.
So right there, that tells you something. And that was 1970.
Well, let's go to Joe Califano, the corporate attorney for the Washington Post Company. He told you that publisher Kay Graham was more relieved the Newsweek suit settled. He said to you that she was more of a businesswoman than a publisher, more than any kind of feminist. So I'm wondering, you know, was the sense of fairness that Joe identified suitably progressive enough for the time? What was Kay's thoughts into this matter? Were you able to really ascertain whether her level of support was, I suppose, commensurate with the severe gender gap that the lawsuit sought to rectify?
Well, Kay Graham has an interesting life, which she wrote about beautifully in her autobiography, which if people haven't read, they must read. It's extraordinary. And she was, as a young woman, she worked as a reporter. She went home, she got married to this incredibly talented man, Phil Graham, who then started running the paper. She retreated to the house to raise four children. And when her husband died, she stepped back in to keep the company in her family. And was running the Washington Post company, which owned Newsweek when we sued. But as she describes herself in her book, she was a very insecure person, insecure about her own talents. So at the time of our lawsuit, when she was notified that the women sued, her first question to Oz Elliott was, which side am I supposed to be on?
Yes.
Clearly recognizing that she was a boss, but she was also a woman. And of course, as a woman publisher of the Washington Post, she was one of two women publishers of major media, the other being Dorothy Schiff at the New York Post. So she clearly was the only woman in the room many, many times. And we asked her to come to our negotiations, which she refused. She said that the men would negotiate for her.
The men would negotate for her.
Well, for the company, that they understood the magazine best and they would be the best in negotiating. She did come to one meeting, which was really interesting. She happened to be in the building when we were negotiating. Our lawyer at the time was Eleanor Holmes Norton, now the representative from the District of Columbia. And Eleanor heard that Kay Graham was in her New York office down the hall. And she stopped the meeting in Oz's office and said, I understand Mrs. Graham is here. I would like her to attend this meeting, and I'm not going to continue until she does. So one of the editors pulled her in, and she came in, sort of, and she sat down and sort of twisted her legs around. And we were discussing how Val Gary, who was covering the UN and writing reports all the time about what was going on in the UN, when a UN official was invited to lunch, she was not included. And yet all the reporting on the UN was being done by a woman. And we all remember more or less what Kay said. She said, well, you know, I've been to those lunches and, you know, they're really very boring. And by the time you get the UN guy and his people and then top editors of Newsweek and the foreign editor, there really isn't enough room around the table for anybody else.
Yes.
And we all left the meeting just horrified. And Eleanor said to us, well, maybe it's a good thing Kay Graham wasn't in the negotiations at the time. But a year and a half later, we had to sue again because nothing much had happened. And this time, as you said, Joe Califano represented the Washington Post, and I believe she pretty much said to him, go up and settle this thing. And in 1971, she met Gloria Steinem. Gloria was looking to find some money to fund Ms. Magazine, which she was starting. And as Kay says in her book, Gloria Steinem was the person who she most credits with getting her to understand what the women's movement about. She was very put off by the style of feminism at the time. So I think by 1973, when we were negotiating our second suit, she was prepared to, you know, understand the issues and get it settled. But as Joe said, she wasn't a feminist. She was a businesswoman. And I don't know how, in the end, she ultimately did feel about women's issues. She certainly always did the right thing. She was a very moral woman, and as we saw in Watergate, a very courageous woman.
Sure. Speaking of Eleanor, I mean, the importance of having a good attorney. I mean, do you think that if you had not had such a fearless advocate that you would have managed to see this kind of traction at all? Or?
Well, I think having a 5'7" 7-month pregnant black woman with a giant afro talk to men who considered themselves, you know, the forerunners of great media coverage of the civil rights movement was definitely had an impact.
We need more of them today, I think.
Yeah, probably. And you know, Oz in his book talks about how stunned he was by this woman when she walked in and how angry she was. And Eleanor can use anger extremely effectively.
Oh, how so?
We were in a meeting, and at one point, Oz Elliott said to her, "You know, I understand about the women's issues, and yes, we really want to try to do this, but you know, we also need to hire black men at this magazine as well." And she looked at him and said, "Mr. Elliott, all you're telling me is now you've got two problems." So she held his feet to the fire. Eleanor moved pretty quickly on to becoming the city human rights commissioner for New York. We didn't realize that Mayor Lindsay had asked her to do that. So she actually only negotiated with us for about a month or 6 weeks, although we had pretty much finished negotiations. But I think because she was in a hurry, we didn't get into the depth and the specificities that we did the second time around.
Yeah.
And that, I think, the second suit, when we hired Harriet Rabb, who was a brilliant lawyer, she was running an employment rights clinic at Columbia Law School, she really used goals and timetables and numbers and how to compare people with similar experiences and make us a class that was clearly excluded when other people who looked just like us were getting ahead.
Going back to what you just said about Eleanor saying you've got two problems, Margot Jefferson, she told you that there was never any attempt by black reporters to organize at Newsweek. So Jefferson said that this was pretty much because there wasn't a critical mass of blacks on the magazine. Do you know if this was typical of black reporters at the time? And I'm wondering, was there any effort by the woman to unite their organizational efforts with black reporters? Was there any talk of that in these mysterious meetings?
No, that's a very good question. I mean, obviously we would have loved the black researchers to join us. We understood that their priority was to the civil rights movement and to the black struggle, and they felt that that was something they wanted to work on, and that our concerns as very privileged white women were not exactly the same of theirs. But in 1972, seven black reporters on the Washington Post sued the Washington Post.
Yes.
Called the Metro Seven. And so, you know, clearly blacks were beginning also to sue in the media. Why didn't we come back later, after our first or second suit, and talk to them about organizing for blacks at the magazine is a good idea. Clearly, Newsweek started hiring more and more blacks.
Yeah.
And they also had training programs specifically for black reporters and writers. So I think Oz and the editors were making good efforts to do something, but our profession is still very bad in terms of African Americans. Our numbers are very low.
What about women as well, just to kind of get a sense of what the ongoing problems are? I mean, if we have low numbers for African Americans, you know, do you think that women have made enough headway over the years to atone for the disparity? Or, and how does it compare to other industries? Because, you know, of course, women typically make 2/3 the salary that a man does. It's an ongoing problem. What makes something like the journalism industry the ideal prism to look at this tremendous income gender gap?
Yeah. Well, I do think the media is a reflection of society, so it's a fair question. I don't understand pay inequity. I don't understand why, still, after all these years, two people doing the same job are not paid. I mean, to me, that's just pure discrimination or sexism or whatever you want to call it, or racism. But I don't get that. I do think that the media has now many, many women in jobs they never before had. There are White House correspondents, there are women covering. You cannot turn on television and not find a woman covering the war in Iraq and Afghanistan and Syria. They're everywhere. And as you know, since the 70s, women have been the majority of journalism graduates. And probably
majority of graduates, period.
And now the majority of graduates. But I just mean in journalism programs and in graduate programs for journalism since the 80s, they've been over 50%. Although, as you know, not every journalist has gone to journalism school or needs to go to journalism school.
Or can, because newspapers are being gutted, bureaus are dissolving, and so forth.
But, you know, unlike business or law, you can be a journalist without having gone to journalism school. So the feeder, the pipeline, as we used to call it, we thought it was a pipeline issue 40 years ago. You just get women in the pipeline, and of course they'll rise to the top. Well, in many cases, they have. They've risen through middle and senior management pretty well, as they have, by the way, in corporate America. I was the editor of Working Woman magazine in the mid-90s. Women were already 50% of managers at that point. So they're in the management ranks. Now, which part of the management ranks is really interesting. In corporate America at that time, they were HR, they were in advertising and marketing, they were not in finance, they were not doing the hard numbers. In the media world, that has changed too, as women are taking on hard news, war reporting, foreign correspondence, etc. Where you still see the glass ceiling these days in both corporate America and in the media is at the very top. Yeah. There are just so few women at the top.
Yeah. I wanted to actually go back to the post-Newsweek atmosphere, the post-Newsweek suit atmosphere. You mentioned a good deal of tryout sessions for women. There were also writer training programs, we talked about this in reference to black reporters. But I'm wondering, because there were early issues in terms of meeting quotas with memos of understanding and so forth, I'm wondering, do you feel this was a sufficient way to rectify the gender gap even after you got them to agree and abide by the second memorandum of understanding, that these training programs and these tryout sessions, were they fair, or did they, even in their efforts to include both genders, they still were prioritizing men and so forth?
Well, I think that the training program for being a reporter actually meant going out to a bureau and reporting.
Yes.
And that, I think, is true for anybody, whether you're black or a woman or something. I think it just gives somebody the opportunity to show they can do the work.
Yes.
The issue with writing was completely different because, as you know, writing is incredibly subjective. And it was both a feeling that there was discrimination and bias against women, and also, I must say, a lack of confidence with us, whether we really could do that kind of writing. News magazine writing is a very particular kind of writing.
Yeah.
And so we asked to be trained as writers, partly to see if we could do it the way many of us thought we could, but we weren't sure, and partly that because we thought we could do it, once we could show sort of trusted teachers who were the top writers at Newsweek who gave this course, they would be able to recommend to the editors, men to men, yes, they can do this job. So that was a sort of combination. I think it ultimately only lasted over a period of maybe 6 or 8 sessions. And then it kind of died out because enough women were then writing and coming in as writers.
What of this sexual energy you describe roughly around 1968, where you have rampant affairs going on in the restroom? How much of this do you think was directly attributable to the sexual revolution? And how do you think this reinforced gender roles in the newsroom? I'm not sure if you saw Hannah Rosen's article in this month's issue of The Atlantic, where she describes how hookup culture is actually empowering women. So what was the difference, and how did this affect, gender gap in terms of vocation and in terms of who got the opportunities and so forth?
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because before the sexual revolution, so the pill came on sale in 1960, 61. So people weren't really sort of into the sexual revolution till the mid to late 60s.
Yes.
And many of the affairs, as I understand it, I wasn't there at Time and Newsweek in this very, the women are the handmaidens to the glorified writers, were between married men and what would be researchers or secretaries.
Yes.
And so it was very much that sort of a thing. Once the mid-60s happened, and so many of us who were in our early 20s, men and women, were hired, and we had the pill, and culture was saying, having sex is fine, there was no AIDS, there was just a lot more sex going on, not between higher and lower entirely, but just in the office in general. Whether you were married, whether you were single, whether you were a married man or a married woman, there was just a lot of sex going on in the culture, and it was safe.
Yeah.
And it was even encouraged by the culture. So I don't
think... Did it have any real impact, though, on vocation and so forth?
In a few cases, as I said in the book, there was inappropriate behavior. I mean, people said things inappropriately. People touched people inappropriately. Certainly, an editor who was sleeping with his direct report promoted that direct report. The fact is that many people slept with the people who reported to them, which would not be sanctioned today.
Yeah, sure.
Not necessarily because people thought they'd get ahead, but it just sort of happened that there you were.
But it seems to me that even if, I mean, to use a crass term, a woman slept her way to the top, it seemed to me, based off of your book, that she really could not, because they were still, especially in Newsweek, there are going to still be researchers. There's still going to be fact checkers. And even if they went ahead and boffed every single person in the office, they would still be researchers and fact checkers, because that was the tradition that Oz said.
Yeah. I have to say, of course, most of the sex was consensual.
Of course.
But you're right. I mean, you couldn't sleep your way to the top.
Yeah.
And people, I know more of this at Time than Newsweek, but many top editors married secretaries or researchers, but they didn't become writers.
Yeah.
So that was not why you weren't sleeping your way to the top. You might sleep your way to the next promotion.
Yeah.
But that would be about it.
Yes. It was more recreational, in other words.
Very.
Okay. I actually wanted to ask you about Aaron Sorkin's The Newsroom, which a number of people, aside from, of course, the endless Sorkinian diatribes and rants, a number of critics have pointed out that, well, you know, some of the female characters in that are fairly one-dimensional. Vulture's Chadwick Matlin even suggested that these women were silent bearers of sexism. And so I wanted to ask you, it seemed fairly pertinent in light of your book, do you feel that gender roles presented through something like The Newsroom have any effect on how women are perceived in the real world? How do newsroom gender battles differ from, say, battles in other vocations? And how does something like The Newsroom kind of create these impressions and so forth?
Well, I mean, you know, I actually haven't seen The Newsroom, although I've read a lot about it. I have it taped. There's no question that you can have good guys and bad guys, and you can have good women and bad women. And so I don't really like to say everything breaks down on gender roles, because there are very good bosses who are men and there are very bad bosses who are women. And I would like to think that we could recognize the difference of the two without assuming that one woman stands for all womankind.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I also wanted to ask you, you point to a 2011 global report on the status of women in the news media, in which areas of the world with the most women near the top of their news organizations are places like Europe, Scandinavian countries, and so forth. The reason why these specific regions are doing better is because these areas of the world have greater support for, you know, for parenthood, for single mothers. There's a support system in place for parents. Since the Newsweek settlement, you know, what advances would you say there have been in the States? Does America stand any chance of catching up to, say, Europe or the Scandinavian nations?
Well, you know, it's really I think one of the great problems that we still haven't solved is this work-family situation.
Yeah.
I mean, the women's movement always asked for and demanded sort of accessible, affordable daycare, and actually had a bill that was passed by Congress that was vetoed by Nixon because he said it would hurt the nuclear family to provide daycare. And there's never been able to be a strong political movement behind it to get legislation again. And it's a tragedy that we are an industrialized country, the most industrialized country, with no supports, public or private, for families who have children.
Yeah.
And I do think that that is one of the reasons that a lot of women who are still primarily responsible for raising children don't take jobs that are incredibly strenuous and stressful and take all of their time, is that they are forced to make this choice between raising children and working around the clock. And I don't understand, especially with technology, why corporations and companies aren't more flexible in letting people do both. I do think that as women become more college graduates, if you just said it's 58% now of college graduates are women, who are also suited for many of the knowledge industries that are growing. So as we're losing men, and as manufacturing and sort of things that revolve around strength and other attributes of men are declining, we have to worry about men too. I mean, we have to worry about what's happening with men in this country. And this should be an issue. I mean, the women's movement has always invited men and included men. And I think we have to go forward together with men to figure out this problem, because there's been a great push for women. We've made enormous progress because of the women's movement. And now I think we have to include men into, especially in this movement of trying to get corporate cultures to be more welcoming to family people.
Yeah. On the other hand, a lot of men have made the adjustment of basically being the sole person who takes care of the kids at home, because the women actually are able to not only get the jobs but also maintain them. The realist might reply to your idea here and say, well, what obligation does corporate America have to provide? Or corporate America, even if we were to legislate heavily against them, they would still enforce the same abuses. And so what has happened is that the family has been forced to adjust by having the man be the sole parent at home. I don't know if I have a question here. I think the question is you know, maybe it's not necessarily a bad thing for women for the man to be at home.
Don't think it's a bad thing if the man feels comfortable about that.
If he feels comfortable, yeah.
And then the question is when the children are back in school and what the man wants to do. I do think there's still a stigma, unfortunately, against men who are at home, and they have to deal with that. If you look at many of the very women at the very top of corporate America, many of them have husbands who may be teachers or have much more flexible professions than the women do. So it's not that I think that's a bad idea. I think it's a fine idea. But I do think that, what I'm hoping is that companies are going to have to keep their most skilled and most talented labor. And if women are graduating colleges at the rate we are, it's going to be women.
Yeah.
And that's an issue for the country.
Oh, yeah. Well, on that note, I think that seems a good time to close this conversation. Lynn, thanks so much. It was a pleasure to chat.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
All the girls whose hearts have been broken, see them tread on your shadow today. All the girls whose hearts have been stolen.